This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello and thank you very much for choosing to listen to this. I'm Mark Stephen. We build the Scotland Outdoors Podcast from the live programme we do for BBC Radio Scotland, which is called Out of Doors. And this week, a whole range of issues came to the fore, not least of which, some very good news about something I was worried about last week. There's a big church about 200 metres away from me, and it's got a spire, admittedly, but it's a large part of the building, and it's a grey slate roof and red coping tiles across the top. Now, on top of the red coping tiles, there are 17 herring gulls. 16 of them are facing south. One of them is facing north. This programme is that herring gull. Good morning. I'm Mark Stephen here at Peachgrove, crossing Bamfordshire this fine Saturday morning, scratching his head for all sorts of reasons, Mr. Ewan McElrath.
Almost stunned to silence.
Nearly.
Drivel. 2 minutes in.
Absolute
nonsense. It's a lovely morning up here. I woke at 3 o'clock this morning to an absolute fantastic fight. I think it was a badger and a pine marten.
Wow.
What a racket. They were screaming and snarling and biting and, oh, absolutely. Entertainment for all. If you can do better than that, get in touch with us. You can text 80295 and your standard network message rate applies. The email address is outofdoors@bbc.co.uk and you can use the telephone 08 085 9295 00 and Quentin's taking your calls. They're probably not called telephones anymore.
Probably not. Yesterday, I'm sure you're aware of this fact, was St. Swithin's Day. You knew that, obviously.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Big implications for us because it was hot in some places and it was torrential rain coming through Aberdeenshire.
Was it? I never saw any rain at all yesterday.
Yeah, I'm bucketing down. No, Aberdeenshire. Were you coming up the road past Brechin? Absolutely monsoon wind.
Yes. Angus, yes. Yeah. Well, yeah, there you go. This is what happened. Anyway, coming up this week.
I do just before that. See, the RSPCA have issued a skate aware alert. Snake aware.
Say that again in English.
Snake escape awareness alert.
No.
Because the weather gets so hot, the snakes get agitated and they escape.
From where?
Pet snakes.
Okay. I've been looking for beavers with Tom Bowser from Argati Red Guides. You can stay tuned for that. And Ewan's been also on the lookout for some elusive wildlife, not snakes, obviously.
Yeah, I've been down on the border with England trying to spot a goat sucker. More on that a bit later. But first, the mystery bird. And it isn't a goat sucker. But see if you can guess what this is. Any ideas on that one?
No.
I wouldn't have got it, I must admit. But Quentin is the man to phone. 08 085 92 95 00.
West Linton is a lovely wee village in the borders that lies on the main route between Edinburgh and Dumfries. Now, Ian Reid, who lives there, got in touch with us to highlight an issue with a local bus service, which it seems may no longer exist within a matter of weeks. It's a situation many rural communities could face. Ewan set off to West Linton to meet up with Doug Veitch and Ian Reid.
As is often the case these days, a post went up on the local Facebook page saying, I heard somebody saying that a bus driver mentioned that the bus service are key only bus service from here to Edinburgh and the other way to Biggar and Dumfries is going to close in about 6 weeks' time. It was such an outlandish kind of comment that it was presumed just to be a rumour or crossed wires. Unfortunately, it proved to be the case, and that is the case. That was 2 weeks ago that we first heard things via the rumour. 2 weeks on, we now know that in 4 weeks' time, as things stand, the bus service is due to close.
When I first heard about it, I thought I was Rip Van Winkle and I'd fallen asleep, and it was April the 1st. I just couldn't believe it.
Because this presumably is an essential service, you know, West Linton, perfect commuting distance by bus to Edinburgh.
It's a commuter village, yes, so there's a lot of travel goes that way. It's also a village where there are a good number of people who need to use the bus to go for health appointments, for example, whether that's in Edinburgh or Pennycook. There's a lot of travel to Pennycook. For example, people will do their weekly big shop there.
Presumably some folk absolutely depend on it for their living.
Yes. There's a good number. I can think of one lad who's really got quite energised by this, who works in Edinburgh. He depends on it. Without a bus, he doesn't have that job. Without that job, it's a difficult time. He's got a young child on its way. Fair play to him. As soon as he heard out and we started a petition, he, for the first time in his life, made a public speech on the bus and spent every journey going back and forth, getting people using the bus to sign that petition. In the space of 9 days, we've now got 10,000 people have signed that petition, which is phenomenal.
It's easy to think of it as a commuter bus only going in Edinburgh. It's far more than that. It's about rural communities, not just our own community. We're caring about every community in this, and it's far more. People use it from all sorts of smaller communities in West Linton as a means to get either to Moffat, Biggar, to then go on further on, and people from here going south. It's not all Edinburgh-centric.
Now, this is quite a complicated story, because you've got the bus company, as far as I understand it, don't want to do it anymore. But there's lots of different councils along that route. Is it difficult to pin anybody down?
It's like nailing jelly to the wall. The bus company do want to do it, but they're increasing the amount that they feel they need in subsidy from the local authorities by 87%, on the back of having had substantial profits and a lot of public money through COVID. The local authorities, they're not as accustomed to working together as we might have expected. So really the drive to bang heads together and get this sorted has come from the bottom up.
Because you don't have much time left.
There's hardly any time left. We've got less than a month now, really, realistically. People need to know before that.
Are you getting any white smoke coming out of various offices in this part of the world?
There's hints. We're hearing where some local authorities are saying we can't afford to contribute or we don't want to. So, for example, the City of Edinburgh and Midlothian, that appears to be the case. Other local authorities, including, to be fair, Scottish Borders Council, are hinting that there may be a solution. Now, we need to know that soon, whether that solution is very localised or whether that solution is right along the route remains to be seen.
There's been some fairly ludicrous suggestions put forward by South Lanarkshire, which involve people travelling south to then go north and such like.
That's a massive journey.
Yeah.
Currently, if somebody is going to Edinburgh from Biggar for their work or for school or university or just for time in town, they've got a bus that will take them there in about an hour. What's been proposed is that... This is just farcical. They would have to get the bus from Biggar to Abingdon Services, wait for an express bus from Abingdon Services to Hart Hill Services, and then catch on the express from Glasgow to Edinburgh.
That's a whole day's travel.
That's a whole day's
alternatively, travel. You get a bus to Carstairs Junction and get one of the two trains a day that go from Carstairs.
Now, you're laughing at this. You're putting a brave face in it. But this is potentially devastating for communities all along this route.
Yes. And I think what does seem to be kind of becoming clearer is that when we think of the amount of money, and this isn't saying that one's better than another, but when we think about, for example, the amount of money that's been invested in the trams in Edinburgh currently, we would like some of that. Yes. And we know it's not easy. We know that the service needs to be improved. Basically, what we are saying now is, can somebody bang heads together and at least have had the reassurance that the service continues for the time being, say for a year. And through that year, we will all sit down, all the different players, and say, How can we not just retain the service long term, but how can we improve it? And also, how can we make sure we're not in this farcical situation where people are finding out with 6 weeks that the service could go?
I think one thing that's got to be remembered is this is a wake-up call to rural communities all over Scotland. And it really, it's a campaign that's almost of a national level, because they can do this anywhere, and they will do. And what they can do is they can reduce our service, the passenger numbers go down drastically, and then they say, well, it's not profitable. We used to have a late-night bus from Edinburgh back to here. That was taken off 4 years ago. So passenger numbers go down.
We've just, and rightly so, given free bus passes to young folk. And it's hugely popular.
And it's pretty useless if you don't have a bus service.
And we're removing the buses. We're committed to net zero. We've got all sorts of net zero targets. And we're removing public transport services. We're about to invest £23 million in the Tweed Trail from Moffat all the way down to Berwick. And we're removing the bus service that runs from the capital city to Moffat. There's just a catalogue of kind of incoherencies.
West London residents Ian Reid and Doug Veach there. That is extraordinary. You know, in Germany, they've reduced public transport costs by 90% to encourage people to use public transport. 90%.
Yeah. But the message is always, you know, we need to make better use of public transport. And I came away from West Linton really angry. Hmm. How can you, as you said, they're putting trails in, they're encouraging people from Edinburgh to go to the borders. Oh, well, let's take away the bus. Fantastic.
It is nuts. Over the past couple of years, lots of us had the time to discover the outdoor hidden gems in our community. Producer Phil Syme has lived in Inverness for around 16 years now, but only a few weeks ago found out that there was actually a nature reserve right in his doorstep. He met up with Caroline Snow, project manager of the Merkinch Local Nature Reserve, for what became a real sensory treat.
We're just coming into the picnic table area, which is at the beginning of the reserve. But I really just wanted to point out a new little wildflower area on our right here. So last year, this was brambles and overgrown and what have you, as it is at the back. But the volunteers that I work with on a Thursday morning have cleared all this back, and they've sown some wildflower seeds here. So at the moment, we've got cornflowers and poppies, foxgloves, and a riot of colour, including other things. There's some marsh marigolds here. And there's other things to follow. We've put in some campion and some teasels and a few sunflowers, because they're rather lovely and cheery as well. As I look over here, there are bees filling themselves with nectar and pollinating as they go. So I think the two things go hand in hand. You know, the joy of us in enjoying the colours, but the knowledge that we're helping insects that desperately need some help at the moment.
Do you know what I absolutely love about this? Literally, Inverness city centre is a 10-minute walk away.
Yep.
You come through a housing estate.
Indeed.
At Merkinch, and you are literally into a nature reserve.
I think it's a really good resource. It's a green space for people to enjoy. And these days, I think we're all becoming more and more aware of how good nature is for our health. We do guided walks twice a week, and people are very welcome to join us. But most people just come down here, they walk their dogs, they take their children out. You never know what you're going to see. There's wildlife at sea. As we arrived this morning, I was watching an osprey fishing. There was a gentleman that he's down here most days. He sent me a message last night showing me pictures of the roe deer that were just fantastic.
How incredible.
So it's a really special place to a lot of people.
Tell me a wee bit about the history of this place. When was the reserve started?
Well, the reserve has, in itself, has been a piece of land for a long time. But the Friends of Merkinch Local Nature Reserve took the reserve on from Highland Council and Scottish Canals about 16 years ago. So they had an agreement that they would look after it on behalf of the people of Inverness and what have you. I'm just slightly distracted as we walk along here. The tide is out, but there's pools. And as I look out, I can see a heron and a couple of gulls standing there, hopefully looking in the rock pools for food and what have you. Around the edge, there are sparrows and often rock pipits, but we'll see what we see as we go along. But they're going through the seaweed looking for insects and bugs and what have you.
But isn't it beautiful that that kind of wildlife is literally on your doorstep? You
know? Absolutely. And from here looking out to sea, you might see seals, you might see dolphins.
This is the Beauly Firth?
It is, yes. So this side of the Keswick Bridge is the Beauly Firth, and then the other side will be the Murray Firth. The dolphins used to come in more regularly than they do. There's an issue with salmon, I think, but I wouldn't pretend to be an expert on that. But I think the dolphins are preferring to be further out at sea looking for other fish. But they're still coming through occasionally. And a few years ago, I was lucky enough to see a pod of whales come through.
Oh, wow.
Now, they were pilot whales and they're a deep sea whale, so they really shouldn't have been here. So it was concerning, but absolutely wonderful to see.
This is also a lovely place to escape the hustle and bustle, isn't it?
Yes. When we listen, almost all we can hear is nature. The birds aren't at their peak just now, but a little bit earlier in the spring, it's just a, you know, a symphony in your ears. Sometimes I say to a group, just stop and close your eyes for a moment and listen to the different sounds. So I'm hearing sort of gulls in front of us and to the left. I can hear the twitterings of songbirds behind us. And rather wonderfully, I can't hear any sign of humans, except for me.
I suppose working in a place like this is where you become so knowledgeable about the wildlife, about the plant life, about the trees.
Never knowledgeable enough for my liking. I learn more and more each year. I would love to know as much as I possibly can. There are birds that I recognise and I will confidently sort of go, oh, there's a chiff-chaff, there's a greenfinch, but sometimes I'm just not sure. So a chiff-chaff, their song is fairly easy to recognise. They make a chiff-chaff, chiff-chaff sound. A great tit makes a sound going teacher, teacher, teacher. So there's little ways of remembering things and what have you once we learn a bit. But I meet a lot of really knowledgeable birders and people who know a great deal, and one in particular comes out for a walk with me almost every Wednesday, and I'm learning so much from him. He's an older gentleman who's been birding since he was a child, and what he doesn't know isn't worth knowing.
Caroline's now chatting to Phil Syme at the Merkinch Nature Reserve in Inverness. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. Coming up, we get the expert take on My Lonely Curlew from last week and the curious tale of Charlie Marioni, who lived in a cave near Cullen.
Yeah, mystery bird day. John and Lewis from the Rothy Norman have been in touch. Good morning, gentlemen, from a sweary Rothy. Why sweary, you cry? Sweary. Why is it sweary? Because I'm loading sheep for the New Deer Show, and it's not conducive to harmony.
No.
Thank you for your calming programme. Is this morning's bird a mystery golden plover? No, it's not. Don't get upset about it, though. Looking forward to you listening on the restful journey of listening to the tups demolishing the trailer.
Aye.
Oh, goodness me. Anyway, mystery bird, it's not a golden plover. Have a wee listen.
Would not get that.
No, but you will be amazed when you find the answer.
Without a doubt. Listener Shirley McHugh contacted us here at BBC Radio Scotland to take part in our project celebrating 100 years of Scottish stories. Now, this is the story she hopes future generations of her family will continue to share.
100 years of Scottish stories on BBC Radio Scotland.
This story is about my father, Tom Park, who was a prisoner of war in Germany. My father was in the Royal Army Medical Corps, and because of that, he wasn't allowed to escape. He had to stay and look after the men in the camps. And the Germans knew that, so he was given a bike so that he could travel from camp to camp. And he had to go past a detail of prisoners mending the roads for the Germans. And because he was a captain, they had to salute him as a superior officer. So he would see them, and they would see him, and they would immediately down tools. And my father would then slow down and cycle very slowly and keep going very slowly past them, and they would salute him until he got as far away from them, as far out of sight as they could. And then they could stop saluting. And at that time, they had had a long rest, and my dad had made sure that they had a long rest as possible. I have to say, I never saw my father cycling in his life, so perhaps that put him off forever.
100 years of Scottish stories. Share your story. Head to bbc.co.uk/Radio Scotland.
Shelley McHugh there with her story. I think that's quite a nice idea, that. Just stall for as long as you possibly can.
Give them all a rest.
Yeah.
But a lot of the stories about, you know, escape committees and everything, a lot of the squaddies got really irritated at these officers constantly trying to escape, and they got punished for it, you know. Mm-hmm. Two or three of them would get away and everybody else had to suffer. They said, just stop it.
Yeah. Well, it is an officer's responsibility to escape.
Yeah.
So they say, you know, anyway.
So they say, and there must be a real... being the medical officer, you're not allowed to escape, you'll have to stay.
Andrew Barry from Roman Camp thinks the mystery bird is a meadow pipit.
But it's not.
Steve from Cambus Barren, on tour at Lunan Bay this weekend, says, is the mystery bird a coal tit? It's not. And he says, yesterday the whole family saw a pod of dolphins off the coast. According to the kids, these are extremely rare, since we live inland. Yeah, well, that's true. They're almost unheard of in Cambus Barren, I would have thought. I
almost never ever see them. Yeah. Are we going to give a clue? Because this is really hard.
I don't know, it's a bit early.
Hard-hearted Laura goes, well, I just... okay, we'll leave it. Hard-hearted Laura says no.
Yeah, well, is that,
if you want to complain, you've got the phone number.
Yeah. Was it not Hard-hearted Hannah, the vamp from Savannah?
Oh, it's a probably. Song. Are you going to sing it?
No, I am not. Fred Gordon thought it might be a kingfisher. That's actually a very good guess. It's not right, but it's a very good guess.
It's not right, because a kingfisher doesn't sound like that.
What does it sound like, then? He said, putting him on the spot.
Give away too many. Let's go.
It's like having one in the room. If you're a regular visitor to farmers' markets in the northeast or beyond, come to that, you may have come across a company called Huntley Herbs. Now, a wee bit of a misnomer, perhaps, as they're probably better known for selling chutneys and jams. There's a story behind that. I went to visit Anna Wilson of Huntley Herbs to discover that the actual herbs are very much back in the agenda.
We started off selling herb plants. My mum started that in 1999. Mm-hmm. That was her sort of initial enthusiasm. And we went round farmers' markets. When we first started, Elgin Market was starting. That was the first farmers' market in the north of Scotland. I think the second one in Scotland altogether after Perth. And we just hit that phenomenon as we started. And so we sold herb plants from markets every week around Aberdeenshire, as far south as Edinburgh. And that did really well for a few years. And then it's just started to tail off, and we had the feeling that everyone who had our plants, who wanted a mugwort, had one.
You'd flogged herbs to everybody that stood still long enough.
Yep, and a lot of them would come up to us and say, that rosemary's fantastic, I've given cuttings to five of my neighbours and my granny. And
thank you.
And we kind of felt we'd saturated the market a little bit. And in Huntley in particular, the supermarkets had just opened, Tesco and Asda both at once, and they started selling common herbs, basil and parsley, and, you know, much cheaper than we could. So we kind of tailed off on that side of things, and we'd been making chutneys and jams for a year or two. They were doing really well, and we thought they had the advantage you could sell them all year round rather than
longer
herbs.
Longer shelf life.
Yeah, much longer shelf life. Because a potted herb, really, it's in prime condition for a week or two. And if you don't have a fast turnover, you've kind of lost it. Mm-hmm. So you have to time and sow in exactly the right quantities really carefully. So we had this fantastically regimented sowing schedule, which kind of worked to some extent. So the chutneys and jams took over, the herbs declined. But the last couple of years, with COVID and baby arriving, my mum died, there have been lots of changes. And it's given us a chance really to reassess, which has been quite good in a way. And so we've started selling herbs online, which wasn't really, I suppose it would have been possible.
How do you do that? How do you package up herbs?
Well, they're a lot easier to package than jam, actually, because they're not so fragile and they're not so heavy. So, yeah, I wrap them. I put usually a sleeve of cardboard around them. I put them in, if there's a lot of them, I put them in a box. If it's just an individual, you can put it in a jiffy bag. Postie comes and collects it, and it goes off down to Essex or South Wales or wherever. So it's just an extra sort of income stream at the moment. We're just feeling our way through, because when we previously sold herbs from the stall, our main sellers were parsley, mint, chives, coriander, as you'd expect, but not really selling them online. And I guess that's because people can buy them everywhere. So I'm selling the more unusual ones, soapwort and mugwort and horseradish and lovage.
Why does somebody buy mugwort?
That's a good question.
That's a good question.
I think in other countries, somebody told me that in Germany they serve it with goose, and it's like it's quite slightly astringent. And
yeah, so it cut through the fattiness.
Fatty. This country, we don't really have a culinary history with it, but it's got a lot of mythical and folklore properties, and I suspect some people are buying it to, you know, cast a wee spell, burn it in their smudge sticks or whatever. I don't know, I don't ask.
You don't know, you don't care, frankly.
The one thing I'm quite careful about is I don't give any medicinal advice. No. And when I'm listing them, I don't even say, you know, take a teacup of this for that, because I think you're getting into dangerous territory. So if people want to consult a herbalist and then buy their own herbs, that's fine. But I'm careful not to let people know what they could be doing with them.
And in terms of the chutneys, do you stick to the sort of, you know, the old favourites, or do you try and dream up new ones every year?
A combination of both. We've certainly... I find it very hard to drop any, because there's always some...
That's my favourite.
A loyal customer base who definitely want to keep buying it. There's always a temptation to keep inventing new ones. That's the fun bit of it, coming up with new recipes and new ideas.
Is it literally still a sort of, you know, kitchen table business?
Pretty much. We did literally start on my parents' kitchen table and their cooker. We converted their living room, in fact, into a chutney kitchen. But it is the same. We've got three cookers now instead of one, but it's just half a size above a domestic saucepan, really, and a domestic cooker.
And what is your personal favourite at the moment?
I like the hot lemon relish, which is the one that has won lots of prizes. It's quite spicy, but it's not blow your head off hot. It's kind of spice for the flavour rather than spice for the... kind of macho spice element. It's got a sweet sour combination that I like.
Fascinating to hear how the business has developed up till now. Where do you think it'll go?
Yeah,
do you want it to get any bigger, or is this comfortable?
No, I mean, to be honest, we've downsized in the last year or two, and which went completely against my instincts and everything we'd been attempting to do for the last 15 years or so, or 20 years. But actually, there are things to recommend it. It's much less frenetic. And we don't have any staff anymore, which is sad. It's a lot less sociable. But on the other hand, that certainly takes away a lot of the pressure to keep the income stream flowing. I think the herbs, it's nice to get back into herbs. We're just standing outside a tunnel at the moment where I've got a sample bed of various herbs that I'm growing for teas. I started testing this last year, just drying them and working out drying times optimally for flavour and storing.
So what is all this?
We've got, first one here is lemon balm, which is a really good tea herb. It's a lovely strong flavour and it's pretty easy to grow. It's hardy. I've got chamomile, which is very popular for teas. And again, it dries really well. And if you're picking it by hand, which we have been so far, you get the whole flower head dried and it looks beautiful in the jar as well, or in the packet. To be honest, we're doing time and motion on that at the moment. I'm not sure how efficient picking it by hand is, really. You get this absolutely pristine, beautiful tea at the end, and it tastes lovely. But I'm not sure what the scaling up capacity for that is. We've got fennel. I've got some marigolds. And mint is outside.
The mint's kind of escaped, hasn't it?
Yeah, and it doesn't need to be indoors. So
it's gone feral.
Yeah. So those are the main ones I'm working on at the moment. And then I think if we can get into teas, they're very postable. You know, they're mainstream. They're not... probably less obscure than chutney. And yeah, it's just getting back to the herbs again, which is where we started.
Anna Wilson from Huntley Herbs. Interesting how what goes around comes around.
Hey, it's lovely. I mean, there's nothing better than going out and just picking your herbs in the garden. And I was thinking about the mint, the mint teas. Remember we went to the Mr. Apple down in near Perth.
Is that where it was? Was there about half a dozen different types of mints?
They had a little walkway with a whole selection of different mints, and we were making tea with the different mints, and it's just so easy and so refreshing, and it's just a lovely cuisine. As I was saying, the mint escapes. It grows wild in Scotland. It's great. And it makes a great tea, just free and simple from the wild.
Yeah, no, I've got mint growing out in the back garden, you know, and there are days when, you know, let's face it, we all have them. You get up and you're just not firing on all cylinders and you're just not 100%.
Surely not.
Well, yeah, no, surprising.
Even you.
Even me. But, you know, you grab a handful of stuff and crush it in your hand and it just seems to pick you up. I don't know why.
It's a lovely, I mean, it's one of those guilty pleasures. You get a handful of something, you crunch it and you stuff it in your face and it's just a wonderful...
I know it's just a turn of phrase, but seriously, are you guilty about any of your pleasures?
Of course. I beat myself with the nettles I've plucked that morning.
Janet Finlayson has sent a nice photograph in of Burnt Island Harbour this morning, sailing into Ainster today. Says, love your programme. Oh. Thank you very much. Looks lovely, too. And Duggan and Aletheon says, morning, chaps. I just heard your piece about the cutting of the bus service to West Linton. I live in the borders town of Innaleithen, and recently the X62 bus service from here to Edinburgh was cut from every half hour to every hour. There is no alternative bus service. How common is this? Give us a shout. You know, let us know, you know, what's actually going on here, because it seems to be a bit of a pattern coming on, to be honest. Coming up, a cave with a fascinating resident near Cullen, and an update on my sad and lonely curlew of last week.
And, of course, it's still time to guess this week's mystery bird, which is very happy. Have a listen. All will be revealed shortly, and remember, you can get in touch with us any time. Tell us what you're up to. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. The text number is 80295, and your standard network message rate will apply. And you can call as well. Quentin's taking the phone calls, 0808592950.
Daniel did phone in, saying, good morning. I'm going to guess the mystery bird is a robin or great tit. I've got both in my garden, or maybe they're both wrong. Sadly, yes, they are both wrong, Daniel. Says, I have to say, I'm thankful for the rain. My water butt was rather empty recently. Oh, that's not code. Hazel from Aberdeen says, is the bird a yellowhammer? And Colin and Kirsten Campbell says, the mystery bird has us flummoxed this week. Could it be a yellow wagtail? We're listening to the show in sunny Numwa in Alsace. Hey, the weather is beautiful.
Are we giving a clue?
It just... Just hold your horses. Just hold your horses.
Right, go on.
Colin and Kirsten say they're seeing lots of blackbirds and spurgies, but nothing more exotic yet. Right, go for it. Give them a clue.
Okay. It's a bird of the shoreline. It's not an inland bird.
Okay. Here's another inland bird, however, because you've been doing some late-night recording this week.
Yeah, on Thursday evening, I went off on a bit of an adventure and met up with Dr. Gavin Patterson of the Borders branch of the Scottish Ornithologist Club at a secret location.
We're close to the English border. We're a little bit south of Jedburgh in commercial forestry.
And the sun's just going down. It's coming up to 10 o'clock at night. Why are we sitting on the English border at 10 o'clock at night?
That's a great question, but hopefully we'll find out soon. Hopefully we'll be rewarded by hearing a very exotic and exciting rare bird, the nightjar.
Because you're beside yourself with excitement when you heard it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's a wonderful sound. It's not bird-like, it's like an insect or a mechanical sound, and it's very exotic, not what you expect to hear in the windy, cold Scottish borders.
We'll go into it in a bit more detail, and, you know, presumably there's no guarantees tonight.
Well, we've found a good spot, and my fingers are crossed. It's a little bit windy, but we're very hopeful.
So, when do they start coming out? When do they... Because it's a special noise, isn't it?
Yes, it's a wonderful noise. So the summer visitors, they arrive here in May, they stay through until August, but they're very rare. They're nocturnal and they're crepuscular, so they're most active at dusk and dawn. And the best chance of finding one is to hear this really distinctive call, the song of the male, which is called churring. And it starts around about 10:30.
And you've been hearing it a lot?
Yep, we've got a known site, we've been monitoring this site, we've got audio recorders, and we've been coming out and listening in person as well. We know that birds are here on territory, and that's why we're very hopeful we can hear the amazing sound tonight with you.
So how did you find them? Because that's a vast forest out there, and presumably they're pretty thin on the ground in Scotland.
absolutely very rare in Scotland, and we've got a large area to cover, but we know there's lots of suitable habitat. So commercial forestry, they like a mosaic of habitats with mature trees and particularly clear fells. And we've got five audio recorders from the SOC Endowment Fund, and these are specialised wildlife recorders, and we've been positioning these out at night, and they record through the night, and it saves people having to come out and listen and be eaten by mosquitoes, and that's been a really big help for us to find these birds.
But you guys are out recording birds all over the borders, you know, seabirds, forest birds. How do you know where to look for something like a nightjar?
So it's a little bit of speculation. It's a little bit about knowing about their habitat and what type of area they might find. It's a little bit about knowing where else they are in the country. So we know there's a few nightjars in Dumfries and Galloway and also in Northumberland, and very similar habitat to that we have in the borders. So that gave us some confidence that if we made the effort, we could actually find these birds.
Because that's a big area to cover. I mean, obviously, your recording traps help a lot, but still a big area to cover.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the first year of our survey. So in some way, we're finding our fate, and we're hoping to work together with other people to best come up with a strategy that we can strategically and sustainably monitor nightjar across the borders going forward.
So what was it like when you first heard it?
I was really excited. Very excited. We did, as much as we were confident we might find some, like you suggest, it's a bit of a needle in a haystack. They're elusive and rare birds, so yeah, I was absolutely delighted when we found this one.
We'll go into a bit more detail later on when we get down into the forest about what they are and what's going on. But most folk, I mean, I've said to a few folk today, oh, we're going to try and hear nightjars. They didn't even know we had them in Scotland.
Well, hopefully you'll get a pleasant surprise when we pick one up shortly, absolutely.
So how many do you think are out there?
So in Dumfries and Galloway, there's maybe 50, 60 churring males.
I mean, out here tonight?
Out here tonight, I think there might be a couple.
And how long do they stay here?
They'll stay here until mid-August.
How many folk are actually out there trying to record these birds?
In the borders at the minute, it's a small group of four or five enthusiasts, but hopefully as we start to find birds and have some success, we'll hopefully build that up and, like I say, have a sustainable, systematic survey across the borders.
Well, why'd you do it? You know, it's midsummer, but it's getting damn cold.
Yep, there's a breeze up, and if the breeze wasn't here, there'd be midges eating us away. So, yeah, why do we do it? It's late at night. I guess there's a sense of discovery. I guess it's reassuring when you find some rare birds and you see some good news around wildlife.
Yeah, but why did you get out there and record all the birds in the borders?
It's really good from a conservation point of view, so they can monitor trends, we can identify important areas, and we can feed that into planning applications and other avenues that can help the birds in the long term.
So, no guarantees tonight, but you've got high hopes?
Absolutely, yep.
And admire your confidence.
Dr. Gavin Patterson of the Borders branch of the Scottish Ornithologist Club. And we'll leave you in that cliffhanger to come back later to Ewan's foray into the dark woods of Jedburgh.
Yeah, I've just got a red squirrel.
Have you?
10 feet from me.
Ooh.
Looking at me. It's heading for the peanuts, but what a way to start a morning.
As long as it doesn't attack your leg again.
Well, there's also the potential for a three-way fight with a badger, the pine marten and the red squirrel. You know, it's all happening. Make your own entertainment in the country.
I tell you, you'll be able to sell tickets to this shortly. We were speaking last week about the move by the Cairngorms National Park Authority to take a lead role in bringing Eurasian beavers to the park. Now, at the same time, we also spotted that beavers at Agati Red Kites near Stirling had produced at least one kit. Now, you may remember I spoke to Tom Bowser at Agati wee while ago when we took delivery of some beavers in November last year. So, thought this is a good opportunity to actually catch up and see how the beavers have been getting on.
So I'll take you in through the gate here. We'll be on the opposite side of the pond from the beaver lodge, so we'll be able to go in nice and quietly, and I'll show you the dam that they've built.
Okay. Are they likely to be around at this time of day?
No, we'll be okay at this time. Mother beaver at the moment, since she's been nursing, she's turning up at all sorts of weird hours in the afternoon, and usually about 4 o'clock now, get a little ping on the app on my phone, which is linked to a camera I've got here, and that's Mama Beaver coming out to hoover up all the food that we put out before the others can get it.
Right, got it.
Go on,
and have you seen the kit?
Not yet, not in the flesh, only on the camera. Okay. It's coming in the middle of the night, it seems, at the moment. So
okay.
At the moment, just the adults and last year's kits.
Okay. This is not the pond we were at the last time.
No, this is release pond 2. Brought you up here because there's a few interesting things to show you about what they've done to the landscape up here.
Again, we're just making our way through trees down towards this. I have to say, it looks like a very, very muddy pond.
Yes, do you know, things are getting quite worrying here with the weather. I know it's great to be working outdoors in this beautiful sunshine, but I've never seen the water levels in our ponds so low. Just give you an idea of what we're looking at on the far side. Do you see where the brambles are over there? Just to the left, that's the beaver lodge.
Okay.
Now, these are the most ungrateful beavers in the world, Mark, because hidden behind the trees here is a beautiful beaver lodge that we built ourselves.
And they don't like yours.
And they don't like ours, no. But worse than that. So we brought in an old pig ark for the roof, and we chopped loads of bits of stick and bought hay bales to put in there and all sorts. And the tractor got bogged trying to put the pig ark in, all this stuff, because it was February and it was all mushy as hell. And they stripped off all the stuff we put in there and built their tiny wee pad next door when they could have had the penthouse here. One of the beaver forage trails here where they're coming out of the water. Mm-hmm. I suppose an animal the size of a fat lab is going to be making some pretty obvious
fat
sounds.
Lab. Fat lab with a flat tail.
And here's the dam here.
Yeah. See the footprints and the marks.
Mm.
Tail dragging.
But look at this now, Mark. So when they built this dam, this place was pretty much unpassable.
Uh-huh.
I remember going up one time with the food for the beavers and trying to go round the back of the dam and thinking, I'm going to die in a beaver wetland here, or at least I'm certainly not going to keep my wellies. But when they first built it, you could see about the top inch of the dam there, and the rest was all lapping water beneath. And now, you know, it's really turning into more of a kind of boggy swamp. Yeah, we badly need some rain, to be honest.
Your beavers are obviously doing fine. How about across the sort of wider picture across Scotland?
It's an interesting time. I think I'd probably like to come back and answer that one properly in a few years. I mean, the stats are showing that their population is growing, despite the fact that there's still a lot of them being killed every year. And the population will continue to grow, and that is a success story. But there's a, I think it's probably more nuanced than that in terms of how we gauge real success, in that, you know, we have this environmental emergency ongoing, and we're still killing a hell of a lot of beavers. You know, there are people coming forward slowly for them. We've got the Cairngorms National Park saying that they're going to lead on the consultations for moving them there. RSPB are looking to move some to their Loch Lomond Reserve, and a few others, but not huge numbers.
It's kind of, I mean, you're obviously involved with this intimately, but I mean, it's a confusing picture from the outside, because in one stage you're told, yes, this is a protected species now, but licences are still being issued to cull them, and you think, well, make your mind up.
It's very confusing. I mean, the whole system that was set up a few years ago was never going to be sustainable. You know, as you say, beavers are kind of protected, but in reality kind of not. And no real scrutiny either, it seems, on how the beavers are being killed, because bodies aren't coming in. It's very worrying. And, you know, I don't think that future generations are going to look back and think that we handled this particularly well, to be honest. And that goes from the Scottish Government right the way down. What I hope now, though, is that we do get to the point where we start to move beyond this. And what that needs, I think, again, is from the top down. I think it needs clear direction from the Scottish Government of saying that, you know, we are going to finance this adequately, so that then people who are having beaver problems feel that they're sufficiently resourced to be able to deal with the capital costs of that. Sort that out, and so many beaver problems are going to disappear. But we also, I think, as a conservation-minded country and society, there's a big challenge on all these people now, you know, people who like beavers, organisations that support them, that, you know, you're actually going to have to put your head above the parapet here and come forward for beavers if you have land to make it available for them. Otherwise, you know, we're not going to make a dent in the culling. You know, there are going to be people that can't live with beavers, It's all very well. We made a lot of progress on pressuring for them to be moved rather than killed, but if there's nowhere to move them to, we've got a problem.
Yeah, just step forward and stick your hand in. Mm. Right, let's get that frown off your face and put a smile back on it. When do you think you will see the kit here?
I'm hoping it'll happen in the coming weeks. We're out pretty much all the time watching them, and yeah, hopefully in the coming weeks. I think our kit probably emerged a bit earlier than some of the other people I know that watch them. It's frown well off the face now. It is such a thrill that they've produced young. And we don't know how many. All we've seen is one kit on the camera so far, but given that was the middle of the night and that's just where the one camera is positioned, there could be more. So real excitement. It shows that they've definitely settled and bonded with this area, which is a real thrill. It's absolutely what we dreamt of when doing this. It's really, really good. So this is where will be when the water level rises again. You can see they've drawn in all sorts of random stuff into here, lots of dead wood.
See, I would have looked at this and not realised it was a beaver dam.
But you know, the funny thing is, when they first built it, even when the water level was up, I looked at it and I thought, that ridge, I don't remember that being there. And it was only when I came round the back that I started to see the big giveaway. You see that there?
Yeah.
Big pile of old fencing wire, obviously just dumped by some former inhabitant here when the fence was knackered, but they dragged all of that plus the old rotten strainer post in. Huge, great big tangle. I don't know how the hell they did it.
Must be hell of a straw.
Must be, yeah.
Aquatic badgers.
Yeah, interesting.
You mentioned the phrase beaver dam, and I think of Ricola sticks, the kind of thing I've seen in Canada. This is much more like an earth bank, as if somebody's actually taken a digger in here and dragged up a ridge.
Really interesting, isn't it? Yeah. It's just a few wee giveaways. Somewhere in here, there's a pile of old plastic tree guards that they've ripped off one of the trees here and put in. The wire there is the other real kind of giveaway. But otherwise, you wouldn't even know. You really wouldn't know. It's really impressive what they can do with some fairly random materials.
Tom Bowser from the Agati Red Kite Centre there with these beavers and beaver dam.
Yeah, it's great that, I mean, some people, as Tom was saying, don't like beavers, can't get on with beavers, but the fact that the government, Nature Scott and folk like the Cairngorms National Park are taking the initiative and saying they're not recolonising as fast as they should be, just apply and we'll see if we can get beavers with you. Mm. We'd love to have beavers, it'd be great.
But as Tom said, you know, it does kind of rely on people, you know, if they support beavers, saying, well, I've got a bit of land here, or here's a water course, whatever, I am happy to have beavers on my land. It's effectively, it's volunteers they're looking for now.
Yeah, but it's raising the profile, and hopefully the Cairngorms National Park will do that. Raising the profile, in fact, this is an option if you've got some land that's a bit boggy and whatever. And what could be better if you've got a bit of boggy, useless land than having beavers on it? I mean, fantastic.
But I was really surprised, you know, you showed me that, because it's a big pile of tangled straight wire, basically, you know, and a strainer post attached to it, and the beavers have just dragged it out of the way. I mean, I'm not sure I could have done it, to be honest.
Yeah, it was a whole new market for it. Beavers, come and tidy up your farm.
Last week, we played a piece with my observations on a curlew I'd been noticing quite a lot in the fields near my house. Now, here's a wee reminder.
But recently, if I've been in amongst the horses, it will not only land in the same field, it'll actually start to come towards you. And I've never seen a curlew do that before. Just flew down the hill there, and it's landed in the field below me, and it's raining quite heavily at the moment. It's a wading bird, it doesn't care less. I see its head, and that long bill just making its way through the long grass has taken off again, but it's almost as if it wants the company. And perhaps more worryingly still, I've only ever seen the one. I think that was one of a pair that was nesting in the field, two fields away, if that makes sense. But that was cut for silage. And I wonder if it lost its mate and its chicks.
Now, after we played the piece last week, Norrie Russell of RSPB in Strathalladale and Sutherland got in touch with a very detailed email that made it immediately, quite comprehensively, clear quite how wrong I had got my analysis of the situation there. We've got Norrie on the line now. I confess I gone a bit Mills and Boone on that, Norrie. What was I actually seeing?
Well, it's fantastic that the level of concern you're demonstrating for the curlew, and that he might be having a hard time there and be getting a bit lonesome. But I don't think you really need to worry, because I think what you were seeing was really a good news story. That would almost certainly be a curlew, a male curlew, most likely, that still has a brood. And if you're getting to this point in the year and you've got a single curlew calling and showing some signs of mild alarm, if you like, then you've almost certainly got a pair that still have a brood. The interesting thing about curlews is that the female, she's put so much effort into all that egg laying and nesting that quite early on in the brood rearing period, she heads off back to the coast to feed up on big juicy lugworms and ragworms. And the male tends to do the later part of looking after the brood. So I think what you saw was that the male, that the alarm is probably because you're in amongst the horses, so it's just being... Yeah, you're only mildly alarming, Mark, so don't worry about it.
No, he's very alarming.
And so he's just warning the chicks that you're around, and they will do this mock attack thing where if they perceive you as some sort of a threat, they will run towards you. So if he had a particularly short beak, that would make it much more likely that he was the male, and his behaviour sounds absolutely perfect for having a brood. So that's great news.
So do the chicks stay together or do they disperse quite quickly?
The chicks, quite early on they start to... They move around once they've hatched. So again, with the bird starting a couple of fields away... and nesting there, they tend to wander quite loosely with the chicks scattered about. So curlew chicks are quite large. It's quite a large bird, so they have to watch out for predators, and by having the chicks sort of spread around, it makes it less likely that a passing fox or something is going to take all of the brood. So... And then they'll gradually... I mean, the ones up the back of my house here, they nest almost three-quarters of a mile away from where they'll spend most of the time with the brood. And there's a point in the... usually after about a week after they hatch them, that they move down off the moorland on the edge of the floes here. And they come past the house quite closely. And that's usually the point where I'll get curlew... Birds actually sort of running at me occasionally, and certainly calling at us if we're out in the garden. And then they'll head down into the fields below us, which are nice grassland, sort of open hay fields and grazed pasture. And that's really the key place for them for raising the brood. And they'll pretty much spend their time in there after that.
How long are they vulnerable for? I mean, I'm not just curlew I'm thinking about here, but other wading birds which do not nest up trees.
Well, that is the unfortunate thing about all the waders, or most of the waders. There are waders that nest up trees. There's always exceptions, of course, like wood sandpiper. But they're ground nesters, so they're very vulnerable to predation during the nesting period and chick rearing. Only about a third of nests would normally survive, and because they've got these long-lived, takes a long time for a curlew to reach fledging and be able to fly away, they're vulnerable for a much longer period of time than something even like a lapwing, say. So that is why they're really one of the fastest declining species in the UK. They're, despite being a very long-lived birds, the adults can live over 30 years, but they're still not producing enough chicks to replace the adult population, and so the population is shrinking, and we've lost sort of two-thirds of our curlew in Scotland even, which you would think would be one of the heartlands for curlew. But there's many land use change threats as well. One of the things that's interesting about curlew is this kind of like shift to slightly towards males doing a fair chunk of the rearing. And I think the wading birds, and I've always been fascinated by them. You've got this complete range in wading birds, from phalaropes, redneck phalaropes, or dotterel, where the females are the bright, gaudy, colourful birds. They do all the displaying, the males are dull and do all the incubation of the eggs and the chick rearing, and the females go off, try to court another male and put him on a nest. So at one end you've got these quite back, what sounds to us like a very reverse situation, and at the other end you've got the rough, where the males have big spectacular headdresses of sort of Jacobean wigs, different colours in the breeding season, and they sort of prance around and show off, and then they disappear, and the female does all the incubation. So you've got those two extremes.
No, right, I was genuinely delighted to be, you know, to be wrong last week, and your answer was so comprehensive. That's why we thought we actually need to get you on just to explain all this. Norrie Russell, really appreciate your time, and thanks for getting in touch.
Great stuff, and good luck with the curlews.
Yeah, well, we live in hope. That was Norrie Russell of RSPB in Strathallidale in Sutherland there. You're listening to Out of Doors here on BBC Radio Scotland. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith. If you miss any of this, there are a few ways of listening again.
Yeah, because this is the only programme that performs with a Jacobean wig. You can look up the programme on BBC site.
And a bit of a swagger too. Or you can download the Scotland Outdoors podcast, which is available from BBC Sounds. We like hearing where you listen. Email us your stories, which is what Dave Frost did. I thought, to be honest, his is more of a request. He said, "My wife and I are regular listeners down here in the Cotswolds, thanks to the internet. On Saturday the 16th of July, today, we'll be travelling up to the Trossachs, brackets again, and listening in the car. Any chance of giving her a mention on your show after 7 a.m, as we should be on the road by then?"
Yeah, her name is Lisa Frost from Stroud, and it would make her day to hear her give us a shout-out. Many thanks in anticipation, and kind regards, Dave Frost.
You're listening to Out of Doors. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElraith on BBC Radio Scotland. Just a reminder, in case you missed it, that we're taking Out of Doors to the Edinburgh Festival this year. We'll be live on Saturday the 13th of August. And if you'd like to be in the audience for that, bear in mind, it does kick off at 6:30 in the morning. So it's on your own head. You can apply for tickets now.
Yeah, now, get a pencil, listen carefully. Go to bbc.co.uk/shows-and-tours. That's /shows-and-tours. Go to the shows section in the site and search Edinburgh Festivals. The link will also be on our programme page. The tickets will be distributed via a random draw, and you can apply at any time up until 11:55 p.m. on Monday the 25th of July. Now, the mystery bird is, we're jamming the switchboard at the moment. Marina Premney says, could it be a green shank? Graham and Denny, a rock pipit. Excellent programme as usual this morning. Hazel, is it a sanderling? And Paul says, is the mystery bird an oyster catcher? Well, no, it's not. Alistair and Elgin says, my feeble attempt this morning is a whittier. And thank you for raising the issue of rural bus services. So many reasons for these services to be retained. Employment, health employment, environment and social outings. Local authorities need reminder that they are here for us and not the other way round. Nothing like a good rant in the morning to get me up and running. Anyway, here's the bird. Have a listen.
I'm not allowed
to give any more clues.
Get in touch, email.
It's got a very distinctive walk. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Text 80295. Your standard network message rate will apply. And Quentin is having a busy morning.
He isn't.
085-9295-00.
Jock says, you mentioned bus services earlier. Jock says the late night bus service to and from Macrahanish to Campbelltown was withdrawn during COVID and hasn't been reinstated. On inquiring why, its viability was given as the reason. So from 5:30 p.m. until 7:15 a.m. there is no public transport to and from the villages on this route. I think that's, what, about 7 miles? Five, 7 miles? Something like that.
And there's so much of that. I was speaking to a lady in Dufton, and she can get a bus to Elgin to do her shopping, but she can't get back the same day.
Just daft. And Laura Rinkham says, good morning from the Netherlands, where some nearby nature includes red squirrels, wild boar, and very occasional black woodpecker. Wolves too, but never seen one. Is the mystery bird a... And she gets the correct answer. Normally listen to the podcast. Delighted to discover there's a whole 1.5 hours of this. Thanks for a fantastic show. Keeps me connected to home. Well, glad to help. So, back to the borders now. And Ewan's pursuit of the elusive nightjar.
Yeah, Gavin, I got my hopes up that we would be in with a good chance of us seeing at least one. Here's how we get on. Well, it's just about 25 past 10. Kind of expecting it now.
Yep, should kick in a few minutes' time, hopefully.
They're pretty accurate, are they?
They are, yep. They tend to chur over quite a tight window, from our experience, about 10:30 to 11 o'clock. So, showtime should be very shortly.
Okay, we're joined by Alistair. Are you confident they're out there?
I'm certain they're out there, yeah. We've been down here a couple of times before. We know that it's holding the territory around here, so I think it should hopefully just be a case of waiting.
So what we're listening for? Churring noise, obviously.
Yeah, it's a really unique kind of mechanical whirring noise. There's nothing quite like it. There's a grasshopper going in the bushes behind us.
A grasshopper warbler rather than a grasshopper,
yeah? Yeah, yeah. Grasshopper warbler in the bushes behind us, which is the only thing that's similar. But when you do hear it, it really is pretty different to that.
And we're in the middle of midgy hell at the moment, but presumably this is good for the nightjar.
Absolutely. So insect voracious, they eat moths and other flying insects like beetles and dragonflies. So we're in a good spot, obviously.
But they use their eyes, they're not using echolocation or anything like that.
That's right. So they don't detect their prey by sound or by echolocation, but by sight, and they're very well adapted for that in their biology. So they've got relatively large eyes, they've got a special reflective membrane in their eyes to help with light gathering, and the photosensitive cells in their eyes are particularly adapted for low light conditions.
And they'll use the moon as well, won't they?
Yes, that's right. They're particularly active when the moon's bright, and they try and cycle their breeding cycle so that the moon is out and bright when they've got chicks and they have to feed the most.
Well, that's clever.
Yeah, it's quite amazing. Really very well adapted birds. Also, in terms of feeding insects at night, they've got a very small bill but a very large mouth, and they can open up that horizontally and vertically to create a big mouth that can grab insects as they fly around. And they've also got bristles or whiskers on the outside of their mouth, and that's thought to help detect prey and to funnel it into the mouth.
And they're pretty ugly looking birds.
Yeah, they look exactly like a log or a branch, and they tend to lie straight along another log or a branch as well, so they're almost impossible to see. I don't think I've ever met anybody that's actually seen one.
I've seen one.
Well, there you go.
I've never heard the call, but I have seen one during the day on a log. Yeah. These midges are getting intensive. Yeah. So we should start, if they're there, hearing something soon. What's happening?
I can see one flying through the middle there. It might have come down on a tree. Can't see where it went, but it's definitely a nightjar.
Good. So you're seeing them?
So we're seeing them. We're just hoping they start churring.
So you've still got your glasses on there, your binoculars. What's going on?
So we have an owl, probably a long-eared owl, perched on a dead tree in the middle of the clearing, and it seems to be upsetting the nightjar. He's made several swoops past it, mobbing it, and it might be that's why we haven't heard the nightjar just yet. He's anxious about this owl. But we're watching it. Hopefully they will move off and the nightjar will start his churring call soon.
So is that a contact call?
No, that's a territorial call. That's a way of attracting a mate and setting up a territory and defending that from competing males.
And owls. Sorry, you just heard something?
Yeah, we just heard the first start of the nightjar churring in the distance. Okay. So if we listen carefully, hopefully we can hear it much better. I've heard it much closer than that. So if we're patient, hopefully it'll move closer to us and we can hear the churring much better.
It's okay. I think it was a woodcock just came over just now.
Oh, I missed that. I was too engrossed in the nightjar.
The microphone's picking this up properly. It's quite a constant noise now, almost electronic sort of noise. But it's like nothing else I've ever heard before.
It's a fabulous noise. An amazing ventriloquial.
A bit like a corncrete can throw its voice.
Yeah, very difficult to pinpoint. As the male moves his head around, it's ventriloquial and it's hard to pinpoint where it's coming from. Yeah. And he'll be singing perched somewhere on a favourite branch. And it'll be so hard to find in this low light.
Well, it's all gone very dark and very quiet. But we did see them, did hear them, and it was faint, but we were definitely there.
Yep, definitely. We saw a male who's got very distinctive white flashes on his tail and wings, and we did hear the male churring. It was distant, but you could hear it well, the ventriloquial quality, the mechanical noise.
You can feel that trailing up and down as well.
Yeah, changes in pitch and pace, and that's 30 or 40 notes per second as he's churring. So, yeah, it's still here, still holding on territory, and hopefully breeding successfully.
That's part of the joy of bird watching and wildlife watching, isn't it?
It's partly the discovery, not knowing what you are going to see when it does come off like that. It's pretty special, though.
Mm-hmm. So, we're giving it 7 out of 10?
8 out of 10. It's a very, very rare bird, particularly in Scotland. And we saw it and heard it, so we'll give it an 8 out of 10.
Brilliant. Well, we saw it, we heard it, it exists, and we got eaten alive.
Were the midges bad?
I mustn't grumble. I'm scratch...
Bit late, don't worry about that.
Scratching my head, because, you know, it was very faint, and it made it more difficult because of the midges and the headphones.
Yes.
Quite often all you hear was...
Yeah, high-pitched whining. And the midges were making a bad noise too.
Yeah, but I mean, thank you very much to Gavin and Alistair for taking me out there. And we did hear it, and how he spotted it in the darkness, I'll never know, but he absolutely nailed it, but it was brilliant. Difficult to hear, some of you...
Oh, I could hear it.
You could hear it.
I could hear it,
yeah. You could hear it, but this is what it's like close up. So... That's what it sounds like. Okay. That's not my recording, I must tell you, but it was just a great experience, and if you get the chance to get out and listen for a nightjar, it's wonderful.
And it's incredible that you could see and hear a bird that rare in Scotland just 2 minutes' walk from the road.
2 minutes is a wildlife expert's term for a long walk.
Miles later. What time frame are we using here? Never mind. Scotland isn't short of horror stories of people living in caves and frightening the locals. I mean, think about things like Sonny Bean. There are some very well documented cases of people living off grid all around our coast and getting on extremely well with their house dwelling neighbours. One such tale takes place just outside Cullen. Our reporter Emily Esson took a walk from Finland to Castle just to see what she could learn about it.
I've left the golden sands of Sunnyside Beach behind me And it feels like I'm venturing further into jungle rather than towards another bit of beach. Ferns higher than my head, kind of obscuring everything and just catching occasional glimpses of sea before they're obscured again by nettles and ferns and goodness knows what else. And stumbled upon a little opening and a signpost to Charlie's cave. And this is the cave of the Hermit of Cullen, the Cullen Caveman, or by his full and proper name, Charlie Marioni. And the story goes that Charlie was a deserter from the French Navy during World War I. By all accounts, he didn't really enjoy French Navy life. So one day when the ship was in Plymouth, he slipped away and decided to start a new life. And eventually, much, much, much further north, landed here, just a little bit east of Cullen. This was around the very tail end of 1920. And he found in this tiny little bit of coastline a little crevice and started to build what would become his home for the next 13 years out of driftwood and bits and pieces that had washed up on the shore. Charlie had his own little garden out the front of his cave where he grew potatoes and vegetables. He caught fish by himself and also rabbits caught off the cliffs and the hillside around and about. And with the rabbit, he also then traded that. He became a little bit of a local legend in many respects. People started coming to visit him specifically. And by all accounts, he bought himself a fiddle to play to people, to continue to earn a couple of pennies here and there. He also asked the local chemist to take some photographs of him outside of his cliffside home, and he sold these as postcards to people who would come and visit him. And you can actually see some of these photos online. A fantastic little snapshot in time, and Charlie at the front beaming away. However, after quite a few years, things for Charlie weren't looking so good anymore. The landowner at the top of the cliff, Mrs. Murray, had been quite unsettled by Charlie's appearance in the first place, and this little trickle of visitors soon became a torrent across her land and her farm, which she was very unhappy with. So after 13 years of living in his little cliffside home, Charlie was arrested on the grounds of being an illegal unregistered alien who had set up home without permission. So he appeared shortly afterwards in the Banff Sheriff Court. And by all accounts, the sheriff had quite a bit of sympathy for Charlie, who rocked up on his court date in a very smart suit and tie, and who also had the backing of a number of locals. Nevertheless, Charlie was fined 20 shillings and ordered to register himself in Banff as an alien. Charlie paid the fine, but decided that if this was the sort of reception that he was going to get, it was maybe time to move on. It's thought that he wanted to return to France, and he eventually made his way to Leith to see the French consul about the possibility of returning to his home country. However, he never made the crossing, and the last that was heard of him was that he was in an internment camp in England, where he died just 4 years later. Meanwhile, Charlie's cave here in Cullen also came to an unfortunate end. A local farmer decided that it would be unwise to leave such a dwelling unoccupied and instead set fire to it, burning all of the scavenged timber and everything that remained of Charlie's home here. However, if we round the corner just now, we should be able to see just the faint remnants of those burn marks, which are sadly all that remain of the cave of the Hermit of Cullen. And there it is. And you can see how hot and how long this fire burned for. The stone here is scarred, not only blackened, but you can see where actually bits of it have started to melt slightly. So the outcropping here faces in towards the cliffs. So you're very, very sheltered. This makes sense as a place to set up home, if any would. It's not a sort of cave dwelling that you might imagine as something that you could crawl inside, more the fact that it's just got a bit of a bowl carved out of a rock, which you could then lean up your driftwood. I can see why Charlie chose this spot to set up home, because just around the corner there are lots of good rock pools and fishing spots. His garden would have been very sheltered and no doubt very productive. But his legacy lives on. If you come down here, you can also see some more of those photos that were taken by the chemist of Charlie as he sits outside and he tends to his garden. Clearly, he was so loved by the locals that they kept his name and his story alive to this day. 100 years later, people can still learn about him, and they can see where this man once lived, grew his food, and where he might sit of an evening watching the sunset.
Emily Essen there with the tale of Charlie Marioni. This is unfortunately an anonymous text, which is sad really. It says, my husband Jack Smedley's from Cullen and wrote and recorded a tune called Marioni's about the spot of the cave. It was played at our wedding last year as I walked down the aisle. A bonny tune that took us back to that beautiful spot in Cullen. That's a nice point.
That's a great story. Loads of correct answers. David Nargile, Dunkey and Ullapool, Derek and Forth. Is it this, which is facing southwest? I don't know what's going on in your head, Derek. Phil for Penrith got it right. He says, if there was a sound of water in the background, I would say it was definitely a common sandpiper. But there isn't, so I will say it's a common sandpiper. And Mike Dingwall from Torfinns right, and David Long from Spottygood all got it right.
Rosie and Blairgowrie says, often seen and heard along the Tay and Hill Lochans round about here, beautiful morning. Liz got it correct, previously lived by the sea in Argyll, often hear them on my early morning outings. Stuart Taylor got the correct answer. Scott Bennett from Scarister on the Isle of Harris. They see them on the beach in front of their house. They have a lovely painting of three of them in their living room by Andrew Miller Monday. And from Alan Mould in Edinburgh, he got it correct, saying, I'm just getting up to start packing to travel to our boat at Dunstaffnage for a 2-week sailing trip. Hope this fab weather continues. Absolutely great. But the correct answer, obviously, is the sandpiper.
The sandpiper is a bird with attitude, strutting along the water's edge, stopping every couple of paces to bob up and down. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm the man. Imagine John Travolta goes to the beach. It's known as teetering. But once that image of staying alive is in your head, it's hard to shift it. And they are a delight to watch. A small bird. Unlike many waders, it doesn't have webbed feet like others who ply their trade amongst the flotsam and jetsam. A narrow beak, perfectly adapted to raking about the shoreline on the hunt for insects and small crabs. They love it here, especially on the western edge of Scotland, where as we speak, the males will be sitting on eggs. Because the sandpiper has evolved a unique adaptation in some parts of the world to take advantage of the long hours of daylight. Now, my swallows, for example, tackle the issue of producing as many young as possible by having numerous clutches over the summer, as many as 3 different broods in one season. But the sandpiper ploughs a different furrow, because the females focus on egg-laying and the males focus on child-rearing. In the breeding season, female sandpipers establish breeding territories which they vigorously defend from other females, and where they court up to 4 different males with elaborate swooping displays and, of course, strutting. Over a 6 to 7 week season, they lay an average of 8 eggs, but up to 20 are possible, with never more than 4 in one nest. And biological changes evolve to support this reproductive process. The females undergo a 7-fold increase in testosterone, promoting their active courting and territory defence. At the same time, males produce high levels of prolactin, a hormone that promotes parental caregiving. So the females establish a territory, find 4 or 5 potential males, lay eggs in each nest, and leave them to bring up the kids. And it's clever. Rather than stretching breeding over the summer, she sends up to 20 chicks into the next generation for only 2 or 3 weeks' effort. A different take on succession planning. But they've also entered our folklore. Celtic mythology also has some thoughts on the sandpiper. In this tradition, the bird is seen as a symbol of transition or change, because the birds are constantly on the move, never staying in one place for long and finding food where none seems available. Our ancestors believed that the sandpiper could help guide individuals through times of change and transition, offering them guidance and support as they navigate the new path. And finally, the sandpiper has entered many cultures throughout the world. In ancient China, there's tale of a sandpiper that lives by the water. One day, a sandpiper was searching for his next meal when he spied a clam spread open, sunning himself. The sandpiper looked hungrily at the clam's soft, white flesh, and it suddenly pounced on the clam, poking his beak in. Immediately, the clam clamped shut hard on the sandpiper's beak and trapped him. The sandpiper struggled, still wanting to eat that soft, juicy clam, but unable to move. The bird mumbled to the clam, "If you always clamp me like this, what good is done? If it doesn't rain today or tomorrow or the next day or I put you back in the water, you will not be able to survive." The clam replied, "If I don't let go of you today or the next day, you can't eat and you can't drink. And then what are the chances of finding a live sandpiper?" So both sides remained that way for days. Stalemate. Then a fisherman happened to come along, and without the slightest effort, he grabbed them both in their stubbornness, and in the end, the sandpiper and the clam both found their way onto his dining table. And the moral is clear. People sometimes argue with each other endlessly over a small issue, but the result often is mutual loss to the benefit of others. The sandpiper, the vanguard of alternative sexual landscapes, and a message for us all. Sometimes it's good to compromise.
Vanguard of alternative sexual landscapes.
Yeah, you don't hear that often on the radio.
But it's strange. Strange, but that's very true. You don't hear it very often.
I was childishly delighted with that phrase when it popped out of my head and onto the computer.
Just pop it straight back in again. Bobby and Wormick got the correct answer. John McKenzie and Orkney got it too. Paddy and Aberdeen, Rose Scott and the Black Isle, Malcolm from Collantrave, Andrew and Ross from Lochgarry, Ross and Tainault, Keith in Hertfordshire, Alan Mark, Sandy Johnson Langside, Mary from Huntley, Marlies McKeon, Trish and Lorna McGregor. It was tough.
I thought it was going to be hard. I would never have got that.
No, I wouldn't have.
Well, all we said it was a seabird, but...
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what I would have done.
You would have just sulked in the corner and gazed wildly.
Same as I usually do.
Yeah. Hey, we had a lovely tweet from Janice Forsyth.
Oh, yes.
BBC Scotland fan. Oh, the wonder that is out of doors. I mean, we could stop there and bask
just
in that
stop
if
there.
We wanted.
Just stop there.
No. Yeah. Oh, the wonder that is out of doors. On the edge of my seat, listening for the nightjar in the middle of Midge Hell. Brilliant radio. Well, thank you, Janice. Lovely to get a wee pat in the back from a superstar.
Just exactly. Stake you and out into the countryside to attract all the midges that way. We've kicked off something with the buses too. Unknown text saying, number 101, 102, no public transport access to the east side of the Pentlands beyond Hill End.
Bend, no round walk starting finishing at Flaunterston, 9 mile Burn, Carlops, West Linson, et al. Hope somebody's listening to this. Ross Dixon says, morning guys, you might want to add the X3436 in North Ayrshire to your list of vanishing, supposedly non-viable buses. Sounds like it's covering or not covering a far wider area. Death by a thousand cuts. This, when petrol prices are going through the absolute roof and people want to go back to public transport. Joan Sex saying, love of the programme as usual, but could I just say Argatti is pronounced Argatti. Emphasis on the R. Don't want to appear a clever pants, but hope it helps. Listen, we used to be proven wrong. It's kind of our default position.
We have a permanent slot, the Mark and Ewan are wrong slot. Yep. It's highly popular.
And we cater we for learn it a lot frequently. That way. We do learn
the
a
bus
lot
thing.
Way.
The bus thing, what is going on? I've got a sneaking feeling that it's perhaps because there's so many councils involved in one route. Maybe it should be a Scottish Government thing rather than leaving it to local authorities to subsidise the routes.
Yeah. Well, and obviously, you know, we're not even going to start on the cost of train travel at the moment. Because, you know, because there is a desperate need for public transport, you know. We've got to do something about it.
Yeah, you can get in touch with us. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk.
That's all from us this week. Don't forget our New Scotland Outdoors podcast, available today at noon, and our midweek podcast, which features a series of sound walks I did in the west end of Glasgow. But until then, this has been very relaxing, very nice, sitting here in the sunshine. From all of the team in Aberdeen, thank you very much for listening, and bye for now.